All right, welcome back, Veeam Community Podcast listeners. We're still here at VMworld Barcelona. I'm Clint Wyckoff, and Michael Cade is with me. And Michael, we have some extra special guests that are joining us here today, don't we?
We do indeed. So we have Niels and we have Frank to talk about their new book, their Host Resource Deep Dive book that they've just released. So guys, welcome. Hiya. Hopefully it's all going well for you. Do you want to just give us a brief introduction into what it is that this deep dive book is and what it's on?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having us to start off with. And so the book, yeah, it is about the love, I guess, for the ESXi hypervisor. And there are a lot of things going on scheduling-wise and queuing-wise. And at one point, we're figuring out and researching a lot of deep intel, and it only made sense to write it down and actually create a book around it, because if we have questions on that specific level of the ESXi hypervisor, then well, yeah, we figured other people can be helped with that info as well.
Right. So Niels, you're self-employed, you work for yourself. Frank, you work for VMware now, right?
Correct.
Obviously you have a lot of access to the development team and things at VMware, so did they help out kind of writing the book, or?
Yeah, so I do have access, but the idea was that everything that is in the book can be found online.
Okay.
So other people can, like from a scientific approach, it has to be repetitive, right? So people need to see for themselves that what we say is actually the truth.
Sure.
And I can dig into the deepest of the deepest. I can actually access the code of the hypervisor itself. Problem is, I cannot share it with you, right? So I have to make sure that everything I write, somebody else can verify. So from that, sure, we spoke with some engineers about stuff, but it was mainly to verify our point of view, like, am I seeing this correctly, right? And we got some interesting results some of the time, like, yeah, like not really, and this is an artifact in ESX top, and you have to do it differently. And that led us to other interesting stuff. So one of the things that we heavily rely on is VSI shell inside the hypervisor. Now, I have to make this very clear, VSI shell is not a supported tool. It means that if everything you see inside VSI shell is not a statement for GSS to respond on, but it does help to clarify certain things. And especially Niels went into his drop packet solution, where the ESX top says zero, and he can explain it much better than I can, of course. but VSI shell gave us much better information about, and actually led us to other things to discover, and that basically is how deep does a rabbit hole go, right? And that for us was interesting as well. How are we actually making sure that is still interesting enough for our readers? I can go on and on about the way caching works, but at one point it's just making statements. It doesn't help you to be better at your job,
sure,
right? So there's this point in time where information is not helping your day-to-day job anymore. So that was for us the idea of, okay, where are we stop? Where do we stop? What is the filter?
So does it start at kind of the, and I, forgive me, I haven't read the book, so this is maybe
Shame on you.
Not yet, because I've delivered my 10 pounds of M&Ms.
Oh, okay.
But I will read the book. Anyways, so does it start at the beginning and kind of tell a story of, you know, this is what ESXi is, this is what the shell is, this is what ESX top is, and then get into kind of the weeds? So any kind of Joe end user that isn't necessarily an expert already can pick this up and get value out of it?
Yeah, sure. So what we did, we followed a sort of storyline, if you will. So we always started out with the physical components and made a translation to how the VM kernel is consuming those resources, and on top of that, how the VM itself is hooked into the VM kernel to, again, hook onto the hardware components. So yeah, it's always the same storyline, if you will, per chapter.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess so. From my point, so the original or the first book, if you will, like the clustering book that you guys did, is this a follow-on from from that, or is it completely, like, it's obviously another rabbit hole that you went down around the host resources, like a best practice guide, if you will, where you're using the documentation, everything, all the resource online, to be able to better get more out of your ESXi environments, whereas the clustering guide was more of a, it was best practice as well, but a 101 on the actual clustering of the vSphere.
So yeah, it's actually, you can see it as a prelude, because clustering ties into ESXi host resource management, right?
Yeah.
So that was basically our idea as well. Like, we, so Duncan and I wrote the book on clustering deep dive. Now what we're missing is the same level of depth on CPU, memory, storage, and network from a host perspective, and especially when we talk about HCI and we're talking about all these, like vSAN, where we have localized storage, it is becoming more and more interesting. Like 5 years ago, or 7 years ago, nobody cared about what type of local storage controller there was in the host, right? Even HP actually provided a host without a local storage controller, yeah, a really simple one.
Yeah.
But due to this push of localized resources again, that became interesting. So the focus actually shifted back to the host. How can I build a better host? Which type of hardware do I need to get the best out of this stuff? And that's the reason why we said, okay, now which setting do you need to use? And not only which setting, but if I do this, which knobs are getting
tweaked?
Yeah, exactly, right? So that was first. So if you see that, this is a complement to the host, to the clustering deep dive. So our next book is actually, again, the clustering deep dive. And Niels is going to join us. So Duncan, Niels, and I are writing the new version of the clustering deep dive.
Cool.
So you have two books together, something similar like the old days with the NT resource kits,
sure.
Right? Yeah. That's the same thing we're going to deliver. So you have that one, and you have the clustering deep, and together, these will bring you the overall clustering experience of vSphere, right? And and by the looks, and if you see how many books are getting sold and the attention it gets, people still want it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think they want it because it's not information that's readily available, and it's coming from experts like yourselves that are respected in the industry and have the deep knowledge that you do, right? I mean, let's face it, this stuff isn't necessarily available on Google.com, for instance, right? You can't go out there and get this. So they're looking for, you know, folks like yourselves to write this type of content, and that's why I think that you're seeing a lot of success.
Yeah, it's the way that it's written. I think that's the bit that it keeps the reader engaged as to how you guys have written that. It's not a manual. It's it's more than that. It gives
it's more
you
of a reference,
it's a story.
Guide, if anything, it's a story for sure. So you know, writing a book takes a lot of time. Curious how long it took you to put this one together.
So we figured like 800 hours,
something like that.
Yeah, and that's next to the day job,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, this isn't the day job.
That's the time management and the family quality time management part.
A lot of children tears because of daddy's writing again.
Yeah. So only joy is when I told them we are writing another book.
Yeah, I bet.
So daddy's gone for another year. Oh, but still, we managed, and it's like I said, time management. It's your day job. Your wife needs attention, right? Your
mm-hmm.
kids need attention. Putting them to bed, and then just 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the evening, just open up your laptop, get in the zone, and just test, write a bit, test a little bit more, discuss, and it's several occasions. I'm guessing 80% of the time. Of the evenings, we were stretching it into the night, right?
Oh, yeah.
So like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock.
Definitely.
Wow.
It was insane hours. Yeah.
I can imagine.
And the thing is, so that's the time that you actually produce, right? Either you get test results, or it's not only test results, so actually you start off with, okay, this is basically what I see, so I need to prove this. So how do I prove this? How am I absolutely sure that what I'm seeing is correct? So you need to create a test plan as well. So that takes time to figure out. And because you're doing a test plan, typically other stuff will start to get involved as well. So you need to, like, it's like, look, squirrel, basically, right? At one point you're talking about storage, the next moment you talk about networking. Why? Because those two nodes talk to each other, and you need to understand that maybe your network is actually the bottleneck of your storage solution, or maybe CPU, memory, whatever, right? So you start off with something simple, and in the end, you basically went through the whole spectrum of things to consider. Now, like I said, that's the 700, 800 is basically writing and testing. But in reality, every moment of the day that you're not doing something else, this pops in your mind, like, okay, can I create a test plan like that? Will it affect that? Will I do that? Calling, emailing, texting, LinkedIn messaging to each other, like every way possible of getting, like, okay, what do you think about this? Will it make sense, right? And so it consumes you pretty much on 24 hours a day, right? So sleep is really optional. And
sleeping, you're dead.
yeah, when the book is done, right? So, it's an ongoing process, and I think that's one of the coolest things. This is my fifth book, so there's some addiction to it, right? It's once you're in the middle of a book, you're like, why am I doing this? But eventually, and I think Niels has some stories about this as well. But nothing beats the moment when somebody walks up to you and says, dude, I read your book and this helped me to prove a point to my colleagues, or this saved my butt, trying to be decent. Mm-hmm. this basically helped us to move forward with the company, right? That's what you do it for, nothing else, right? People can say whatever they want to say about it, but look, you're getting attention, it's building your personal brand.
Yeah, sure.
But in reality, the moment when somebody walks up to you and said, you helped out a lot, that is the golden moment.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's all of us are in that similar, like, tech marketing type, office of the CTO type positions, and that's really what we all do that same thing with our breakout sessions, with any content that we deliver. On the book piece, so five books, that's a lot of time if they're all 800 hours or plus more. Did you always think that you were going to write a book, or is that, like, both of you, is it something that you set out thinking or knowing that you wanted to progress down that content path, or is it something that just landed and you took it from there? And
yeah, so in my experience, it I guess it just happened. Yeah, we were talking a lot about it and a lot about that content and a lot about ideas and how the scheduling behaves and stuff like that. And driven by experience from in our day-to-day jobs, right? And it kind of made sense just start working on it, I guess.
Yeah.
There was one point where we said, yeah, okay, we're going to write this down and we create a book, right? But yeah, the old part before, yeah, it's...
So what was the main motivation behind choosing the topic of, you know, CPU scheduling and host performance? What was the main kind of premise? What excited you to go out and write this book?
Oh, that's a really long story for me, but the idea is that, so going back to the question that Mike asked, so back in 2010, I believe, 2009, I was doing a large project together with Duncan in London, and we were talking about the history of your career and where you started and all this stuff, and with Microsoft in the end of the 90s, everybody was doing their MCSE, and I did it as well, NT4, and I bought all these books, but all these books were just basically a collection of screenshots. Mm-hmm. Like, if you want to create a network gateway on your NT4 system, you have to click this button here, you have to click that button here, to the next page, click button here, click button. But it didn't tell me what I was doing. Yeah, the end result, I'm getting a connector, but it didn't show me what actually was happening behind the scenes,
yeah,
right?
It didn't give you the why.
Yeah.
So I read through those books as well, and it was they're manuals, right? And I think that's the difference where you guys have hit the nail, and the other community books that are out there as well. There's a lot of people, that's what I was going to get to next, is there's a lot of people writing technology books now in the form of like how you are telling a story. They're not the traditional Microsoft manual books.
Exactly.
They show that, and I guess that's how you get into that rabbit hole, because each thing you just keep digging and digging and digging and getting down into the weeds, and you're really finding, but like, you're really taking things apart and getting into the deep stuff. So
yeah, and you need to know more than you're actually explaining, right? That's one of the things.
Right.
So with that, I was talking to Duncan about it, and then we basically said, let's write the HA and DRS deep dive. That was the 4.1. That basically get the ball rolling. So when it come, I think 2 years ago, 2 years ago, no, 1 year ago, actually, I left my previous job, and I had nothing to do because I just left, right? So I didn't have any job. So I was like, okay, what do you want to do? What is the coolest thing that you want to do? I can travel, but I traveled for 5 years, so the last thing you want to do is sit on a plane. And I actually started to sit down, and I started to write about CPU architectures, because that's the cool stuff that I enjoy, right? The memory and the CPU and how it worked together. That basically went into the NUMA series, and from that point on, we started talking about a project of his project back in the day, where he's seen some weird performance of CPUs, and that led from one to another. So that was the ideal thing. Like, okay, I already wrote the clustering one. Let's do the same thing, actually one level below on the host. So again, it becomes a resource kit, right? So that was the idea. And Niels knows an insane amount about networking, and I basically know how to connect a computer to a network. So that helped out a lot. So yeah, that was an obvious choice, right?
Cool.
So you mentioned you left your old company, and now you've come back to VMware. You've been focused on the VMware Cloud on AWS now, Frank. So maybe give our listeners a little bit, you know, about what VMware Cloud on AWS is, kind of the different offerings, you know, maybe a little bit about that.
Okay. So the interesting thing is that VMware Cloud on AWS is actually a way to allow the current admins with their current tool set and their current skill set to start consume cloud resources. That's the overall idea. By using vSphere, by using vCenter on an AWS platform or an infrastructure, you can now start to scale out your data center by just adding or migrating VMs to a AWS data center. So the key element to understand is that it's a service, and we will take care of the infrastructure. We will patch it, we will maintain it, we will update it. If there's something wrong, we will fix it for you. And we have some brilliant software that actually make it more automatic. At later versions and future releases, we allow Elastic DRS, for example, where if the cluster is utilized for more than an X percent, let's say this is an arbitrary number, 80% of you set it as a threshold. Once it beyond 80%, it will add another physical host automatically, so you are not running out of resources.
Sure.
So what we're trying to achieve here is that administrators, their day-to-day job is not becoming an infrastructure manager anymore, but a resource consumer, a resource manager. So you only have to figure out where am I going to run my VMs. On premises or in cloud. Now the key part of this partnership is that we developed it together with AWS. So we're using our software in cloud, so vSphere, vSAN, and NSX, and we allow you to natively connect to their services. So you see a lot of customers already using AWS, so they have VMs running on-prem, and they connect to an S3 bucket, or they connect to an EC2 instance. But that costs money, right? So you have network traffic. So one of the things what we can do is we can explore the data gravity world, meaning that if you move that VM to your in-cloud environment just by using a vMotion, the thing you're doing on a database, right? And your CTO wants to become cloud, and use cloud, and you don't have to learn anything new, right? It's just you're moving stuff with what we did for the last 10 years. Now you can actually connect to that native service, such as S3 and EC2 in the current initial availability, and we're going to add more cloud native services in future releases. But the thing is, you connect that VM to your S3 bucket, and it's on the same network, so it's extremely fast. But due to the partnership, we don't require you to go outside to the internet and come back in, so you don't have egress costs.
Sure.
So now you can get really fast new application landscapes
relatively easy
with your current tool set and your skill set, right?
Yep.
Because we use vCenter, so you can use your vRealize suite, you can use third-party options as well. You can just manage that entire environment. And with the elasticity of AWS, you can add more hosts whenever needed. When a host fails with HA, we restart your VMs on another host. But what happens if your host fails for a long-term period? So you have a reduction of resources in your cluster. You have to buy a new host. On average, that takes 86 days on-prem. Right, there's a report of a big information company that says the average is 86 days. With this, it's within moments. Basically, we are beating Amazon Prime when it comes to adding hardware. Right, so if you want to buy in a Dell Blade via Amazon, I don't know if that's possible. But the thing is, if you would get a drone in, like you have it, like in 2 or 4 hours, we're faster than that. Racked, stacked, ready to go. So you don't have to install vSphere anymore. You don't have to configure your networking anymore. Nothing. It's just basically by right click of a button, or with Elastic DRS, or with HA. It's just basically there without any interference of the administrator.
I think that's the most compelling point from my point of view, is the same tool set. There's no training, nothing additional that you need to worry about. And then you can start consuming
right away.
And burst workloads into that cloud, that public cloud offering, where you don't have to go and train.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Like you said, the being able to set a threshold of, say, you know, once my cluster utilization gets to 80% memory utilized, go ahead and add another one in.
Yeah.
That's pretty compelling.
Or if you have seasonal workloads and you know, like, hey, Black Friday is coming up, right? For example, for retailers, you add a couple of servers, and once that period is gone, you just remove them, right? Because we allow for scaling up, but we also allow for scaling down. So it allows you to really start to rethink the way you consume resources, but also how you configure your VMs, right? So now you have to think about, okay, what is the size of my VM? Can I actually, how much resources will it consume? How much resources will it take away from my other VMs? Because 86 days of adding a new host, going back to my boss again and saying, I really need 4 more hosts. Your boss like, okay, let's negotiate. Do you want to have 2, right? And now he basically, I really need 4. But here's the thing with, for example, Elastic DRS, it just shows that you really need it. Right, and you can actually also allow it at one point to remove, or you actually can do it manually, right?
Yeah, and I think that, so if you need 4 because of Black Friday or because of something, then great, we'll go and do that. But then as soon as Black Friday's gone, you just take it away. Like, there's no capital expenditure on buying the physical tin.
It's from a CapEx model to an OpEx model. So from a CTO perspective, this is brilliant, right? So we have customers who are doing a data center zero model. Basically, they're getting out of the business of operating their own data center. It's not their core business. So why are we doing this anymore? Can we consume cloud resources? Yeah, you can, but if I go to another cloud provider, I need to change all my applications. I need to refactor all my applications. Will it perform as well? Will it actually work, right? And of course, there are many experts that can help you with it, and there are services that can help you with it, but you can also vMotion, right? You can just vMotion it so in initial availability, we do a cold migration. In future releases, we are allowing vMotions.
Sure.
From that point on, it's just basically, I don't need this host anymore. Let's put this host into maintenance mode. Let's vMotion these VMs to my AWS data center, to my in-cloud SDDC. And you can decommission your host.
Done.
I think one of the good things as well from a Veeam point of view is the APIs are very similar. So again, they can take that same Veeam backup and replication toolset that they've known worked with on premises and just deploy that in AWS, either as an EC2 instance in the same region, connecting into the vCenter. Ultimately, you're just adding that VMC, VC into VBR exactly the same, and you carry on the backup process that you've been using the same as the on-premises. So that was obviously good for us being
exactly
being joint first to market with that, to be able to protect those workloads. And I guess the key is just to go back to the egress charges. So as soon as you bring in data out, that's when Amazon start charging. So in terms of backup repository placement, that's where you've got to be, from a Veeam point of view, you've got to be clever,
strategic.
In where we situate that. You can have them sat on the actual ESXi hosts within Amazon, because you don't want to be egressing all your backup data out to on-premises. So that's
an expensive thing.
Yeah, exactly. egressing all of
so you mentioned the host patching, updating, all the maintenance, all of that is taken care of by, is it VMware support?
Yes.
Or is it, so it is?
Fully for VMware. So you have one, in California we say we have one shoulder to hug.
No.
Let's do it nicely. So basically, if we will take care of your host, we will monitor your host as well for particular scenarios. If a component fails or if a host fails, we will replace the host with an additional host, with a new host. And if you detect something, you just call VMware and we will take care of that. And one of the cool things is, and so we had a Lighthouse project and a beta project where we went through the motion with some key customers. And one of the things we introduced was the chat function. So people basically could open up their portal, their VMware Cloud and AWS portal, and they had this chat button. And when they clicked on it, they instantly got a global support member, basically asking, okay, what's the problem? What do you see? And they had instant access, right? And typically that solved a lot of problems immediately.
Sure.
That was one of the biggest feedback. So we are there for you. We will take care of your infrastructure. You just need to consume your resources. That's
so
the only thing you do.
Is there ever a handoff to where it would involve AWS support?
Yeah, but that's on the back end. So we will take care of that.
Okay, so the customer, it's completely transparent to them whatsoever.
Yes. Yeah, and most things what we try to do is automatically. So with HA, if a host fails for a longer period of time, like if they have a component failure or a host failure, we will remove that host from the cluster and we will add another host. You don't have to do anything, right? So we will get the data out, we will make sure it's there on the other hosts, and fine.
So the customer doesn't need to worry about having root access or any,
nope.
That is completely abstracted away from them. They don't have...
They have a resource pool, they have users, they have VMs, they have their content library for their images and for their templates, and that's all they need to worry about.
It's amazing, like how you said earlier, taking away from the infrastructure management and making it more about managing the software and VMs, applications, what really matters to the business.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, you know, we talked about your book. We talked about the VMware Cloud on AWS. Any kind of closing takeaways for the listeners? You know, maybe about the book specifically, you know, what are like maybe the top two or three things in your mind that a reader would be most interested in?
So yeah, not per se the content that's in the book, but more who is interested, who should be interested in the book, right? So yeah, it's written around VMware and its hypervisor, but we noticed a lot of love from people in general who loves bare metal hardware, right? Or DBAs who are actually looking into SQL workloads. And so it's not all about the virtualization administrator who is interested in the book, right? It's a broader spectrum of people who should be interested in it. So,
in some of your testing, really quick, if you don't mind. So, in some of the testing and use cases that you mentioned, SQL there, for instance, and that being a very highly virtualized app that's resource intensive, those are specific use cases that you've gone deep into?
No, not specific specifically transactional workloads and stuff like that. Yeah, we mentioned it in the book, if I remember correctly, but it's not pinpointed to a specific workload. Yeah, we talk a lot about transactional workloads and NFE, for example, from a network point of view, but not specifically SQL or SAP HANA or.
Well, one thing that we did do is to, we don't like synthetic benchmarks because that's basically a bandwidth test.
Sure.
What we did was we used DVD store, which is a SQL backend, and which that allows us to actually understand how real life workloads actually behave on with certain settings. And that's what we always say, right? Don't use your own application to test this on. So we can provide you with some options in the book, we can provide you with some examples, but the only way you are sure whether or not it's a good setting for you is to test it with your own hardware.
It all depends, right?
Well, that's the short short answer of things. But
exactly.
It depends. So one thing that I want to add, so we wrote the technical content of the book, but there are actually five people who helped us shaping the book for the reader's mind. So we asked Kit Colbert, the CTO of the Cloud BU, to write the foreword. But we also asked Pat Gelsinger to write the foreword for CPU, because Pat Gelsinger is the grandfather of modern CPUs, right? We asked Christos, who is the CTO for the storage and availability business unit, to talk about storage. Andrew Lambeth, who invented the distributed virtual switch and went to a tiny startup that was being bought by VMware again, who is now NSX, who is one of the lead architects of NSX and a fellow, of course. He wrote the network stuff. And then we went back to the grandfather of DRS to talk about memory. And I think those point of views of those industry legends is also an interesting read. And yeah, we were very, very happy to have them on and share their thoughts in the book.
So the listeners, where would they be able to get a copy of the book? What's the easiest way?
So yeah, it's available on your local Amazon, and we just released the ebook. So yeah, that may be helpful. The thing we did, yeah, books cost money, but we tried to keep, and we talked about this already, right? It's not about making numbers, it's about sharing with the community, so we kept the price as low as possible. So yeah, it's up there for the grabs.
Awesome. And what is the cost?
So the paperback is going for $29, I believe, and the ebook is not even $10. It's $9.99.
Very reasonable.
Yeah.
Very reasonable.
I think it's so. Reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So what we did was self-publishing. So that means that we basically write the content, but it's Amazon who distributes the book. Yeah. It's Amazon who distributes the ebook.
That helps keeps the cost down.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is, not many people know this, but if we want a copy of the book, we actually have to buy it ourselves. So it's your hand of the content, and from that point they run with it. So you get some royalties, of course, but the idea is that there's no publisher who basically prints 5,000 copies and then says how much money, how much do you want? No, it's basically printed per order.
On demand.
On demand. So if I want to have a copy, yeah, they print it for me, but hey, it costs money, right?
Sure.
Because it's not my printer, it's theirs, right? So yeah, that's a funny thing.
All right, Frank, Niels, thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing you around.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.